This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
I'm Tyrus.
I'm Liz Claman.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, February 9th, 2023. I'm Chris Foster. A possible lifeline for abortion rights supporters from a federal judge in D.C.
I think that there are going to be all kinds of interesting legal theories that are floated, but it seems to me that the judge is the one who floated this potential theory in this case versus having the advocates come to her.
We're talking to Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream.
And Lisa Brady. The odds are pretty good that millions of people tuning into the Super Bowl won't just be watching the score.
Gambling is just going to help the TV ratings of all sports because it keeps people locked into the sports almost regardless of what the scores are.
And I'm Riley Gaines. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
President Biden in his State of the Union address didn't spend a lot of time talking about abortion, but says again that Congress should restore federal abortion rights overturned last year by the Supreme Court.
The Vice President and I are doing everything to protect access to reproductive health care and safeguard patient safety. But already more than a dozen states are enforcing extreme abortion bans. Make no mistake about it. If Congress passes a national ban, I will veto it.
Abortion opponents are pushing for a national ban. A federal judge in Washington, D.C., though, wonders if there's a path to bring federal abortion rights back. Judge Colleen Coller-Cotelli, nominated by President Clinton, suggests that the Supreme Court decision finds only that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution does not include abortion rights. What about the 13th?
The 13th Amendment, of course, abolished slavery. And so there have been these arguments among some legal scholars, and certainly in those in the pro-choice world, who say that causing a woman to carry a pregnancy is akin to slavery or to involuntary servitude, that their body is being used for something they don't want to participate in.
Shannon Bream, the host of Fox News Sunday.
Will this judge really go down that path? I mean, anything's possible at this point. And we know that people are looking for the legal fallout. What do we do after Roe v. Wade? It's not something the Supreme Court has considered in that context. So maybe it opens a new front. We'll see.
Yeah, this case has nothing to do really with the legality of abortion. But it seems like she's trying to use it as a backdoor to turn it into that. Does that happen?
Anything is possible, especially on a topic as heated as the issue of abortion. I think that right now people are scrambling who are part of the pro-choice movement to figure out how to navigate this. And it's not surprising that they would look at different legal theories that haven't been used. If the ones that have been used have been struck down in the way that you want to use them, although this now is back at the state level and people do have access, it's just different based on where you live and whether you're, you know, able to travel. There's also the issue of abortion pills through the mail. So I think that there are going to be all kinds of interesting legal theories that are floated, but it seems to me that the judge is the one who floated this potential theory in this case versus having the advocates come to her. So that's kind of an unusual twist.
Yeah, that's what I was like. Right. She, instead of the case coming to her, she's trying to make the case come to me with your thoughts. You mentioned abortion pills. More abortions now than not have been done with medication. Mm-hmm. This federal judge in Texas could rule soon that one of the two drugs in the protocol should be banned. This particular drug has been approved since 2000. Can the courts overrule the FDA on what drugs are okay?
Well, so this is a federal court, and we'll see what they say. You know, the argument is from some of these conservative groups that the drugs are not safe, that they do have potential complications, that politics, I think, sort of sped up or papered over some of the considerations in getting this drug approved. So they're arguing that it actually is dangerous for women in some cases, and that the FDA was playing politics rather than really examining the safety of these drugs and their impacts on women. So we'll see. This is a federal judge at the lowest level. I suspect no matter what happens with this case, it's going to go on appeal. And then after that, probably we'll try to be appealed to the Supreme Court, which doesn't have to take it. But it's a unique question that could end up there.
Yeah. Another one, the First Amendment, providing that Congress make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting its free exercise. Now, some Jewish organizations have sued on those grounds. And according to Jewish law, abortion is permitted and, in fact, required in some cases if the life of the mother's at risk. Are there any cases there that are in the pipeline?
I mean, it's possible. I think that this court has shown a willingness to look at all kinds of religious freedom or religious liberty questions or expression questions through the First Amendment. And again, I think that people who are trying to grapple with what comes after Roe v. Wade are going to try all kinds of unique arguments. I think we should expect that. People will get very creative. That's a very unique one. And that's something that could work its way through the system as well.
We have argument dates now for the student loan forgiveness cases and Title 42 immigration. Which one you want to explain first?
Well, it's interesting that these are kind of, not to get too wonky for people, but it's not clear the court will actually get to the merits, the heart, the core of these cases, because they're sort of about standing, like who can sue over the student loans. For example, there are a number of states that are trying to push back on it. And so can they sue? There are also a couple of plaintiffs who say that their student loan, you know, people who receive student loans, and they want to be able to argue this case about whether or not the forgiveness plan is good or not. And of course, this all comes against the backdrop of the administration had told us that it was the COVID emergency in part, or in, you know, large part, that was the basis of their argument for being able to waive the student loans. They've postponed them 7-8 times. That actually has had a fiscal cost and impact on the federal budget and, you know, spreadsheet. But they've said during the emergency, they had to do it. But we now know, too, the White House has said, technically, the COVID emergency is going to be over May 11th. So these cases will be argued before that, but probably decided after that. It'll be interesting to see if they still maintain that same argument. They've sort of said it was the COVID emergency that launched the idea of getting rid of the student loans and forgiving some of the student loans. But even if the emergency's over, the process was started during the emergency and it may still continue. So this is all playing out in real time because we would probably expect a decision from the court in June on this case. But if the emergency's over on May 11th and they've already heard the case, I'll be interested to see what the justices do with it.
Yeah, the Title 42 immigration case also came out of the pandemic saying, look, people can't come in to have their case is heard. We need to keep them on the other side of the border because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration seems to have gone back and forth on this one. And now they're saying, look, it's kind of moot anyway, because we want to end it.
Right. And it's so interesting because there have been whispers and chatter throughout Washington that, you know, when Title 42 was kept in place, secretly, there's a part of the administration that's like, okay, good, because the border's a disaster. And we're fighting to get rid of this because during the Trump years, we said it was inhumane, it was cruel, we argued against it, but we actually kind of need to use it right now. So even when they were fighting against it, they said to the court, you know, if you lift it, we need a few weeks to figure this out, give us a little bit of extra time. And so they're kind of in this holding pattern for now. Yes, publicly saying it's terrible, we got to get rid of it. But also some of them quietly saying, we need it to help us manage the situation at the border for now. And again, if that's predicated on the emergency, which is going to be over in May, it's kind of in some ways parallel to the student loan situation in that if you're telling the court that's what it was about, and now you're telling the court you've argued for it and against it, the federal government has Title 42. You know, it's possible this is one of those things that before it's even decided, the court says, okay, you know, we're dismissing this as moot, as improvidently granted, or, you know, it's sort of resolved itself on its own. So we'll see.
I am told, getting off the Supreme Court, that you were invited to the traditional State of the Union day of off-the-record lunch with the president the other day. I know mm-hmm. you can't say what he said specifically. Anything interesting about the experience? It's one that not a lot of us get.
Yeah. I mean, it is always, I mean, I'm always pinching myself. Like I'm a kid who grew up in Tallahassee, you know, wearing hand-me-downs and was the biggest nerd at the table with the big thick glasses all the time and stuff. So I just, when I end up in places like that, I'm like, okay, just remember you're a nerd and you're representing for all of the normal people out there. And I think all of us have a pinch of that when you get the extraordinary chance to go and have lunch with the president at the White House. The one thing that struck me in coming away from it, and he was very forthcoming on so many different topics, very interesting, but I really got this sense for the first time that I don't know he's 100% convinced he's going to run again. And I have been to this point. We've all expected after the State of the Union within the next few weeks that he would launch a big reelection campaign. I'm not sure he's 100% there. He may get there. He may be 99% there, but I did sense there was a little piece of him that was not yet totally sure.
That's very interesting and newsy because of something he said or just the tone of his voice?
A little bit of both. I mean, and I really think that he was so transparent and open with us on so many things that I thought, whoa, okay, we can't use any of this. It's really good because it's just, I think, gut level where his brain is and what he's thinking about things. So it's not something that he said, but I really kind of got the feeling with him that he's just not sure. And I think we've all assumed that he is, but I got the sense that he's still in the decision-making process and he's got to decide soon.
Yeah. Another big deal, Super Bowl Sunday's coming up. I am told also that you are practicing your football throwing in case you're called upon, not on the field, but on TV, I suppose. Do you have reason to believe that this is something you're going to have to be concerned about?
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine if I was called upon on the field? We would all be in serious trouble. First, I would be knocked out from the very first tap on me as a normal human being. Yes, I mean, I have been told and I've been challenged by people like Brian Kilmeade and Bill Hemmer, who will be out there. There may be some times of competition at, say, the NFL experience zones, those kinds of things. So I got to show up with at least some basic skills. I'm good on the running and catching. The passing is not so pretty, I'm working on it because I feel like I cannot embarrass the people who are counting on me. I represent for Fox News Sunday.
I mean, even if you can just keep a tight little spiral, if it doesn't go very far, it'll look okay.
Okay, and that's a thing, though. The tight little spiral, I find, is a lot trickier than you think if you haven't spent the last 50 years of your life throwing a football. So I know the game. I get it. I understand it. I love it. But to actually physically execute it myself, I think, is a bit preposterous. But we're just going to try to do the basics.
Okay, good luck. Don't go viral. I think your goal here is to not be noticed.
Exactly. I mean, I have done a couple of these things where you throw out the first pitch and I literally lose more sleep over that than if, say, you know, I was going to try a case before the Supreme Court. So, you know, just, you know what your lane is. I know what my lane is. It's not throwing a tight spiral.
I have just found out that you have a book release date, March 28th. What's that about?
Oh my goodness. Yes. This is amazing. We have such amazing listeners and viewers who are so kind. The two books I've had out, Women of the Bible Speak and Mothers and Daughters of the Bible Speak, I was told last week, we've almost hit 1 million in sales on those two books. And I'm just so humbled and pleased that people have found encouragement and hope. And I've learned so much of these books and the stories. So the brand new one was released, Love Stories of the Bible. And, you know, people may think, well, how much does the Bible really say about love and sex and marriage and all those things? Actually, a lot. And there are a lot of good stories. There are a lot of messy stories. I think we can learn from all of them. And I think we're all, you know, we need love in our life. We're looking for connection. That can be friendships, romance, it can be community. I think there's a space for all of those relationships in our life. So we dig into those that are in the Bible.
Shannon, I appreciate the connection that we have every week.
I know,
every week.
It's solid. And I feel like it's the kind of friendship that we see in the Bible where people are looking out for each other, for the good of each other, and they care about each other.
Shannon Bream, Fox News Sunday. Thanks.
See ya.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Riley Gaines with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Super Bowl 57 this Sunday will be the first one to happen in a state where sports betting is legal. Arizona.
The Super Bowl is definitely an exciting factor here in the state. Definitely going to bring in a lot of out-of-state visitors, and I like to think sports betting is just another attraction for them.
Max Hartgraves with the Arizona Gaming Commission recommends setting wager limits and sticking to them. Gambling addiction has long been one of the arguments against legalizing sports betting. But since the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way in 2018, more than 30 states plus D.C. have legalized it, with some supporters arguing the oversight can help.
Once you regulate it in New York, now we can monitor accounts. We can see someone who's on their way to getting an addiction.
State Senator Joseph Addabbo Jr. says in New York, most of the taxes and licensing fees, hundreds of millions of dollars, are used for education. The American Gaming Association, the industry's trade group, estimates more than 50 million Americans, about one in five adults, will bet $16 billion on the Super Bowl this year, more than double last year's total.
Legalization of sports gambling in more states, that is going to boost the numbers.
Jeff Clark is a sports betting analyst at Outkick.com, which was acquired by Fox Corp in 2021.
But people have been gambling on the Super Bowl, you know, my whole life, your whole life. And I don't think there's that much more money at stake, but perhaps I'm wrong. I would assume that it's mostly based on just accounting from legalized sports books instead of like bookies who don't really go on record with how much are being bet through them, obviously, because it's illegal.
Well, yeah, and the overall estimate, I think it's the American Gaming Association, actually says that only just over $1 billion out of their $16 billion estimate is from legal bets, which means most wagers are still off the books, including, you know, casual bets between family, friends, coworkers, that kind of thing. Why is that? When legal sports betting is spreading around the country in recent years, why would most of the bets still be off the books? Are people not trusting, you know, the legal betting system?
No, I think it's more of like a familiarity with your local bookmaker type thing. And I also think because local bookmakers will take bets on credit, whereas you need to show up with the cash at DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM, all these legalized sports books, and people would prefer just to bet on credit and then settle with their local bookmaker the following week.
So maybe that's good news for local bookies in terms of, you know, the legalization isn't going to put them out of business, I guess, because some people will always be more comfortable doing it in person or, as you say, doing it on credit if they have to.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think local bookmakers' businesses are going to dry up because people still, for lack of a better way of putting it, need their fix. And if the bookie or the local bookmaker is willing to give it to them on credit only, then, you know, a lot of people are just going to prefer that option. Also, it's like you think about people's significant others having shared bank accounts, of course, like a husband, a wife or whatever. But if you're playing through credit, then there isn't a bank statement, right? So that also would probably incentivize people to continue betting with their local bookmaker.
Sure. How much has the perspective of the leagues changed, do you think, when it comes to sports betting? Because now there are these, I don't want to say endorsements, but combinations happening or affiliations happening between leagues and sports books.
Well, the gambling is just going to help the TV ratings of all sports because it keeps people locked into the sports almost regardless of what the scores are. And we've seen the NBA, I think, is the American professional sports league that has embraced gambling more than any others. I think everyone's been betting. Most people have been betting on football for a long time, but the NBA really has infused sports gambling conversations into all of their pregame, halftime, and postgame commentary. Because if you think of how lopsided some of these NBA games get, the only reason people are sticking around is to see if someone beats the spread or covers that spread or if the over-under cashes. So, I mean, sports leagues are just going to continue to accept marketing dollars from sports books because, A, more money is good, and B, you know, the more people that are gambling on their games, the higher their TV ratings are going to be.
How are the spreads determined for sporting events? Is it different each time? Is it the same people determining the spreads each time?
It's mostly the same people. So there are sharp sports books that are usually they're offshore sports books because they're considered sharper or market making sports books because they take the biggest action. And usually the legalized sports books, either domestically or even internationally, will follow these offshore sports books and pick their spreads almost as like a way to plagiarize and to like have the best number. But it's really most of these spreads are decided by old bookmakers with really, really strong models and algorithms where they simulate the contest based on a whole bunch of different stats. They simulate it thousands, if not millions of times and take the median. And then they serve that spread, that median up to the public. And then based on the public bets, they'll adjust the lines accordingly. So the short answer is it's really only a handful of people that are making the lines and then other sports books are copying them.
Wow. How much research do you have to do when you write a column for OutKick Bets? Because you're not just writing about football, you're writing about a lot of different sports.
It depends on the sport. You know, for golf, which is probably my most successful or the sport that I bet the most, I'm doing a lot of research on it because I've never played golf and I can't eyeball it like I can basketball. Basketball is easier for me to bet because I just grew up paying attention to it, grew up playing it. So like for football, for golf, I'm spending per handicap probably an hour to 90 minutes, you know, to find a bet. So it's a lot of time for me. Some people are much quicker. And the end goal for me, or not the end goal, but one of the short-term goals for me is to streamline the process by effectively building a model and creating my own numbers. But I would say the average like bet, it takes me about 60 to 90 minutes to figure out.
Fans have always been upset over bad calls during a game. But now with money riding on games, in many cases, the officiating is even more scrutinized. Are sports leagues or refs sort of feeling that pressure? Do we have any sense of that?
I'd assume so, yeah, because you just see people complain more and more about calls that don't go their way on social media. And then there's obviously a heightened focus on social media or for social media. So these sports leagues, they have PR departments for their officials, and they'll release public statements through Facebook, through Twitter regarding a certain call or a certain way a game was officiated to kind of address more or less the bettors, but also the fans. So the more gambling becomes prevalent in America, the more scrutinized team sports officiating is going to be.
There are also so many things to bet on, especially with something like the Super Bowl. I mean, people can bet on the color of the Gatorade bath that the winning coach is going to get, right? I guess that's great for people who are looking for more things to bet on, but is that also part of the danger? You know, does this create too many options for someone who maybe shouldn't be betting or shouldn't be betting as much?
I don't think more people are gambling because of these things. I think the people already gambling are willing to bet on these things once like the Super Bowl is here, because it's kind of like, hey, it's the final game of the year. Let's get a little weird. Let's get a little wild. Let's bet on how long the national anthem takes, what color the Gatorade is. The Super Bowl coin flip is another popular one. But to be honest, like I remember as a kid going to Super Bowl parties when sports gambling wasn't legal and people bet on the same stuff just through the local bookmaker. So I don't think that's changed very much. I just think there's a heightened focus on it because sports gambling is kind of out of the shadows now that it's legal in several U.S. states.
Do the apps give refunds if something like an injury happens?
And they have issued refunds recently because of player injuries. And now we're seeing a lot of like sports gamblers, recreational or new sports gamblers, go to Twitter, go to Facebook and like tag the sports book and ask for refunds when a player gets injured. That's a new phenomenon that really needs to stop, but it is something that is becoming more and more popular.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask what you're thinking for Sunday. If you have a big pick, if you have more than one thing that you're picking, what's your outlook?
Yeah, I mean, I'm betting a bunch of different things. Right now, I already have 20 bets in. For the game itself, I'm going to take the Chiefs, and I'll take the +1.5, what it is now. You know, it's based on the same analysis you're probably going to hear a million different places, right? It's the Super Bowl. It's the biggest game in the country and in sports, right? So you're going to hear a lot of the same stuff, but Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs have more experience in this situation. The Eagles have played a much easier strength of schedule. And typically, the team that plays a harder strength of schedule wins the Super Bowl versus the team that's had the easier road there. Also, you know, Patrick Mahomes is you know, by far the better quarterback of the two in the in this matchup. And that's typically what wins football games. You know, what he lost in his previous Super Bowl because their offensive line was so beat up that he didn't have time to throw. But the Chiefs' offensive line is elite now. I think it's going to be able to handle the Philadelphia Eagles' pass rush. And Pat Mahomes and the Chiefs are going to do enough to be able to win that game. That's my analysis of it.
Sports betting analyst Jeff Clark. Outkick Bets is where you can find his column. And you also have a daily podcast, Outkick Bets, with Jeff Clark. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Meet the American who
invented sliced bread.
The invention of sliced bread is the one by which all others are judged. Here's why. Otto Rohwedder was born in Iowa in 1880. He came up with a way to bring pre-sliced bread to consumers for the very first time. He had no background as a baker, engineer, or inventor. In fact, he worked as a jeweler for years until he sold his business to finance his dream. His dream was to make bread better, even though the bread baking industry belittled his vision. He came up with a machine to slice and package fresh loaves of bread right out of the oven. In 1928, he had a prototype that he financed himself, and the Chillicothe Baking Company of Missouri was the first to bite. Using Rohwedder's invention, Chillicothe Baking introduced the first sliced loaves of bread to the public on July 7th, 1928. It was an instant sensation, and the Chillicothe sales shot up by 1,000% in just 2 weeks. Rohwedder was soon selling his sliced bread machines to bakeries all across the country. The invention became so popular that entertainer Red Skelton even used the phrase, "The greatest invention since sliced bread," to describe TV in 1951. The phrase stuck. Otto Rohwedder died in 1960 in Michigan, but his legacy lives on. Today, Chillicothe, Missouri continues to call itself the home of sliced bread. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of foxnews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Raleigh Gaines.
What's on your mind?
As a 12-time NCAA All-American and 5-time SEC champion at the University of Kentucky, I will forever be proud of my accomplishments. Accomplishments that were only attainable as a result of my lifelong dedication to my sport, endless hours of hard work and sacrifice, and the creation of a dedicated women's category in sport. Unfortunately, the women's sporting category is today being eroded by discriminatory policies that allow males who identify as women to compete on women's teams and in women's events. Males are hurtling themselves forward in national rankings, stealing scholarships, titles, and opportunities from women who have worked their whole lives for those accomplishments. In my own personal experience swimming against Leah, formerly Will Thomas, at our NCAA championships last year, I can wholeheartedly attest to the blatantly obvious unfair advantages and discrimination we face as female athletes. Leah Thomas is a 6'4" biological male who swam for 3 years on the men's team at the University of Pennsylvania before switching to the women's team. Thomas was ranked 462nd nationally at best as a male before becoming the fastest female in the country and winning a national title just 1 year later. As if this didn't make enough of a mockery of women's sports, UPenn and the NCAA went on to nominate Thomas for NCAA Woman of the Year, the most prestigious award for collegiate female athletes. Ignoring these biological advantages possessed by males is to undermine the half-century fight of ensuring girls and women have the same access and opportunities as males do in regard to sport. But this is bigger than just missing out in regard to athletic competition. Participation in sports teaches confidence, strength, character, and resiliency that will translate far beyond sports. These are lifelong skills that present unique advantages, contributing greatly to success within careers and relationships. Collegiate female athletes who speak up about the injustice and competitive disadvantage they're at are quickly labeled as transphobic, hateful, and a bigot, along with some other explicit names I won't mention. And trust me, I know. Girls are reluctant to use their voice due to fear of retaliation. They're told they will never get a job or into a graduate program if they speak out. They're told their school has already made their stance for them. They are emotionally blackmailed into thinking that they are wrong for being uncomfortable and dressing in front of a naked man. In this instance, the concerned female athletes are the ones referred to counseling at the LGBTQ plus education center on campus so they can learn of the oppression these trans athletes face. Just ask the female swimmers in the Ivy League. Let me be clear. Women are not inferior to men. We are strong and incredible within our own physical limitations, but we are different in ways that make men advantageous when it relates to something that requires sheer strength and athleticism. I hope we as a society can restore what it means to celebrate the boundless potential of women and their mind-blowing physical ceilings. Sports is a powerful platform to empower girls and women, but this National Girls and Women's Sports Day, I don't feel empowered. I feel betrayed, belittled, and excluded from proper recognition. We should not have to add the term biological in front of the word women to address differences in performance in our separate categories. Women deserve to be recognized without facing overt discrimination. We deserve equal opportunity. We deserve fair competition. We shouldn't be denied the right to consent to being exposed to male nudity in the places where we undress. We should not give up the awards we have earned simply to validate the feelings and identity of a male. There's no equity, sportsmanship, fairness, or opportunities for women to succeed at an elite level without sex-based categories. This is Riley Gaines, a 12-time NCAA All-American swimmer from the University of Kentucky and spokeswoman for the Independent Women's Forum.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.